Across America and around the world, you're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Before we get into tonight's program, ladies and gentlemen, which, by the way, is going to be one of the most important that we've ever done, and make sure that you have pad of paper and pen or pencil by your side all through tonight's episode of the Hour of the Time, and, of course, the later time slot will be continuing. Now, I advise you, if you cannot tape both programs or listen to both programs, that you send and purchase both of the tapes for tonight's The Hour of the Time. If you're not a CADGI member, tapes are $8 per episode. If you are a CADGI member, of course, you know that they are $6. These prices are post-paid, ladies and gentlemen. You do not have to add anything for postage or handling. Send your money to William Cooper, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, spelled Showlow, Arizona, 85901. That's P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. Now, I've been trying to warn patriots in the United States of America about a Trojan horse for a long, long time. And I have reaped quite a bit of unjust criticism and have been personally attacked for trying to keep you all from falling into the trap. I'm going to read you one more expose of a man who goes by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Bo Grites. We call him Bobo Grits here because he is absolutely insane if he thinks that he's going to continue to fool patriots in this country. So for that, he's a Bobo. And I tell you right now that when all of the patriots finally realize who this man really is, they're going to have his butt for breakfast. And we call that Grits where I come from. Headline from the Associated Press. Bo Grites starts supremacist site activist claim. Portland, Oregon. Formal presidential candidate James Bo Grites is establishing a center for white supremacists in central Idaho, a human rights group said Friday. Grites and some ultra-conservative Christian leaders have purchased about 280 acres of land near Kamaya, Idaho, according to a report issued by the Coalition for Human Dignity. The land is held in trust by the Oregon-based Almost Heaven Properties and the Western Development Trust, headed by Jack McLam, a former Phoenix police officer and associate of Grites. Well, folks, if you are an identity Christian, I have nothing against that, for I know that you believe in the separation of races. You don't believe in race wars or hurting other people. And I believe in the freedom to choose where you live and who you associate with. I have no complaint with you. However, those who believe that they are a master race, who would kill anyone who doesn't look like them, talk like them, or believe like them, I have a great bone to pick. And I'm telling you right now that James Bo Grites is out there to find out which of you are going to oppose the New World Order by force of arms. And you'll find yourself taken out of action before you ever have a chance. So you better listen to me. And I hope that you get your head on straight, because there is no master race. Never has been, and never will be. Freedom means freedom for all peoples, of all colors, of all religious persuasions. Anyone who puts limits on freedom are not for freedom. They are, in fact, elitists, no better than those who are trying to enslave us now. Don't get trapped in that, folks. Don't get trapped in it. You haven't got enough people in this whole world to defeat everybody who doesn't look like you or sound like you or worship at the same altar that you do. And if you try to pick that kind of fight, the world will have no other course than to do to you what you plan to do to them. And I would advise you to think very seriously about that. Don't go away, folks. We're going to teach you how to win the coming battle, or at least be as effective as you possibly can with what you have available to you at this time. And remember, as time goes by, availability of our resources will shrink. Ladies and gentlemen, I have sitting with me a man named John. Of course, this is not his real name, and you will not be privy to his real name or location or anything else, who has built what I believe to be the very best weapon that has been built in my lifetime or that I have ever seen or known about, that can be effective at extremely long distances and still be very accurate. Now, you're not going to be able to build what he has built, but you can build something that is very, very close to it. And with absolute perfect conditions, and remember I'm talking about perfect conditions, and if you load your ammunition properly and you're using the proper grain bullet and you've done the modifications that you're going to learn about tonight, which are all perfectly legal and lawful, you may be able to reach out to 1,400 yards. Remember, all modern armies that operate in the world today that would even have any kind of a chance of occupying our country and oppressing our people cannot fight effectively beyond 200 yards. That's a fact. It's in their training manuals. It is proven every day as they fight all over the world. So, John, I'd like you to give some of your background and just establish your credibility for talking about this particular subject. And then let's talk about what made you decide to build a weapon with this kind of capability.
Okay, Bill, I've had a total of we're approaching 25 years currently in the arms trade, small arms trade in one form or another. Shot competitively over that period of time, extensively, in all phases, using all conventional small arms available. And I've been involved solid in the last 13 to 14 years in the area of R&D or research and development, test and evaluation, as well as weapons design and execution, meaning limited production, limited fabrication. By limited, I mean on a custom ordered basis.
In other words, these are the weapons that you don't find in the catalog from a major manufacturer. These are things that are designed, researched, and developed to go beyond usually the capabilities of weapons that have been designed and manufactured on a production line basis.
That's essentially correct, Bill, or maybe more specifically to fill a gap that you would find in the typical catalog, shooter's Bible or wholesale catalog that you might have access to. But yeah, essentially, that's a good description of my area as it has been solid, or what I've been devoted to for the last 13-14 year period. Now, the competitive shooting throughout the last quarter century has exposed me to time and again to typical small arms ballistics limitations. It has exposed me to many other people's ideas, designs, efforts that either fell short or, in some cases, might happen to have excelled in the design purpose for which the weapon I happened to be using at the time was designed. Well, that carries us right on into the mid-80s. During which period I had occasion to design and develop a what you'd have to call light, man-deployable, that is, man-portable, long-range. I don't know if we, in order to be politically correct, we want to call it sniper rifle, or let's just call it long-range elk rifle.
That's fine. Although we don't have a reputation for being politically correct on the hour of the time.
I understood that, so I knew what I was getting into. At any rate, during that time period, if all the gun enthusiasts out there will think back to their typical Guns and Ammo magazine and NRA's Rifleman and whatnot, you were exposed in print and various articles to efforts on the part of, in some cases, larger manufacturers that became engaged in the endeavor of building a conventional actioned rifle or design around an old, old favorite. I can't really call it small arm cartridge, per se. It almost borders militarily on artillery round, but at any rate, specifically the M2 machine gun round, or in other words, the BMG caliber 50 Browning machine gun round. Seems like there was a fad underway during, from say, 84 to about 87, to achieve a mile plus, that is 1 mile, mile is 1,760 yards, rifle, utilizing the venerable ballistics of the caliber 50 BMG round to reach that and beyond with some precision. Now, important thing to remember here is that the Earth's elements bear on ranges so terrifically at anything beyond 500 yards, which, bear in mind, is still in excess of 1/4 mile, and is a substantial range. The elements, wind, atmospheric conditions, humidity, temperature, all of those things come to bear greatly on a small arms projectile that is being asked to follow a given path with some predictability and some precision, to the extent that I don't think we've ever actually entered a science in that direction. What we've done is we've endeavored to provide the highest in precision for a launching pad for an intermediate-sized small arms round that will give an individual a hit probability, I think, is the best term that could be used to describe what it is you're trying to do out there beyond 500 yards or a quarter mile, provide the most precise launching pad for that round. And then, of course, try to achieve the greatest in consistency, what is known as ballistics coefficient with regard to projectiles that are being intended for use beyond those ranges. And the rest of it is more or less kind of all up to Mother Nature, to be honest with you. If you've done your job right, if you've trained properly on the range, and that is to say just real basic match-type shooter technique, got your breathing down, you know what I'm saying,
right.
Your pulse right, rate right, and your timing just right, and try to gear all the mechanical variables in the direction of accuracy out there at 1,000 yards or beyond, then who knows, everything might fall into place. And we've had days where those things do fall into place. But what I'm getting at is the project all began with the 375 improved Magnum, which, by the way, is the designation for a round. Wildcat is a term often used to describe a round such as this one that simply is not available in its current form off the shelf.
The truth is, you can't buy it commercially anywhere.
That's correct. What a Wildcat actually is very simply a casing, small arms ammunition casing, that was formed in one way or another, using one means or another, out of what is known as a parent cartridge. In this case, the 375 improved mag Wildcat is fire formed, is the actual means to describe the metamorphosis through which that casing is put from deriving its current form from its parent, which was specifically the 375 Holland and Holland Magnum.
So now, when you say fire form, for our listeners out there who may not understand some of what we're talking about, you're talking about taking a regular 375 H&H Magnum chambered rifle, and that is drilled out or machined to the new specifications that you wish the shell to conform to, and then a regular 375 H&H Magnum shell is put into that chamber and fired, and the expansion of the gases in firing that round actually pushes the shell out to conform to the new shape of the chamber, and now you have an empty shell that can be reloaded to the improved specifications.
Well, now, see there, Bill, pardon me, with absolutely no small arms manufacturer background, barrel making capability at all, we've brought you around to the level of understanding of a master gunsmith. That's exactly correct.
Well, I have good teachers.
No, that is exactly, precisely correct. It couldn't have been put, I don't think, worded in a more understandable way, you know, to the general public. That's exactly what occurs. Now, this is to be, and I don't mean to sidetrack very far on this, but this is to be differentiated from other means of wildcatting forming. Other means very often will involve a set of dies. To those of you in the listening audience that happen to be hand loaders, you would be familiar with die sets, presses, and the other implements of the typical reloading bench. Die sets that will range from a minimum of 4 dies in a set, clear up to 6, and in some cases 7, what they call case-forming dies, which will put that extruded piece of brass through all sorts of various contortions, finally arriving at a brand new shape, configuration, and dimension. In this particular case, I would have to call, and by the way, that's the reason that this particular Wildcat was selected for this particular project, was that a high degree of practicality and availability, as well as universality, was being sought in this project. In other words, part of the design characteristic of this rifle was to be an achievement in availability of common components, beginning with the 375 Holland and Holland Magnum. The H&H 375 Magnum entered this country from Britain originally as a sporting round, began its career through importation back in 1921, and has achieved a tremendous amount of popularity, particularly, let's say, from Minnesota north all through Canada and on up into Alaska as a big, large game round, meaning, you know, moose, brown bear, grizzly bear, etc.
Has this round been used in big game hunting in Africa before it was curtailed or stopped or whatever's happened over there?
It has. Its application in Africa has it's been considered commonly an intermediate game size round. On the continent, clear on up into some of the heaviest game, white rhino and elephant, and et cetera. However, it's considered generally somewhat light on the heaviest of African game. Now, we could again sideline, and I won't do it now. I'm going to draw the line here because, in the interest of time, we've got an awful lot of ground to cover here this evening. But I might mention that in my studied opinion on that subject, and that is the application of the Holland and Holland 375 round on some of the world's largest game, it's actually superior to the substantially larger bore diameter rounds from, say, 416 on up to 460. Some of your half-inch diameter calibers out there. It is that simply because the 375 possesses some of the highest degree penetration characteristics of any round out there. At higher velocities and a slightly smaller what you call cross-sectional density, its capability to penetrate extremely heavy tissue game and bone structures and attack vitals in very primitive nervous systems is almost second to none. But that's largely been overlooked in the favor of the 40 caliber class, as we call it on the continent. Now, getting back to the 375 selection of this project, as I mentioned, historically, the round found its way into use in the United States in the early 1920s, has achieved a high degree of popularity throughout the contiguous 48 as well as Alaska specifically. So therefore, you really don't have to drive very far or let your fingers do the walking through the phone book very far to find some retailer out there that'll have a stack of four or five boxes in inventory of 375 H&H ammunition, from which, you see, the Wildcat round is derived, or Fireform. So that'll give you a little bit of background as to the reason. Now, beyond that, major considerations in the selection of the round as it pertains to caliber is the commonly used term to describe the diameter of the projectile, is the fact that 375, that is 0.375 or 375 thousandths in machine shop terminology or measurement, relates to a selection of bullets that is more or less the point of no return as you move up in bullet size or diameter as it relates to aerodynamic or flight characteristics or otherwise stability characteristics. What commonly is found as terminology in the typical reloading manual as being ballistic coefficient is the proper term.
So does that mean that this bullet is just about the optimum, or I think that's what you're trying to say?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, from the standpoint that as you increase in size, that is to say diameter above 0.375 caliber, you will find that your factory available bullet selection all of a sudden takes on an entirely different shape, typically, literally shape or configuration. they begin to move toward the blunt nose, round nose, abrupt ogive type configuration, and very typically, almost universally flat base, stern on the bullet, that does not lend itself to long range velocity, stability, energy retention that a much higher ballistic coefficient bullet, as in the typical what we call Spitzer or spire point, or otherwise layman's terms, just pointed long nose tapered ogive type bullet does.
Mm-hmm.
And so you lose the advantage as you move up in diameter, and again referring to what's available in factory produced projectiles for reloading. You lose the advantage of the high coefficient design, which, like I say, the point of no return is definitely 375. Now, in addition to that, 375 also offers the mass as it relates in physical properties to weight, that is up in the 300 grain area or category needed to retain energy way on out there. We're talking extended ranges again that will average, say, in the area of 1,000 yards, but even exceed that. The more mass you have, the more two characteristic desirable flight objectives are obtained. One is the retention of energy as it pertains to the retainment of velocity. Secondly, stability against wind, or what we call wind bucking characteristics.
Right.
As you move down in mass or weight, the more susceptible a round is to deflection from crosswind, the less tendency that round has to retain whatever initial energy or therefore velocity was imparted to it as it left the muzzle of the barrel, whatever velocity it had accelerated to by the time it exited, in other words, the muzzle. And so these are the factors that it is generally considered anywhere around 300 grain mass is sufficient to counter, or in other words, conversely, provide advantage in.
Mm-hmm. So now, I know from talking to you earlier that this was originally brought about by a group of people who wanted to go and hunt in dense brush and have a round that would penetrate the dense brush and still be able to kill the game. And you made those rifles, and then you began to think about something beyond that, because they were talking short range, dense brush, large game. And how did you decide upon the, and not only how, but what did you decide upon would be the proper receptacle or chamber to put this bullet in, from which to fire it, and what kind of a barrel and what kind of an action could withstand the tremendous forces that are going to be placed upon it without causing malfunctions or breaking. And we know that we need something that's going to be extremely reliable in future months and years. I want you to think about that, because I'm going to take a break. Well, go ahead. Let's start that, because I don't want to take it too early. Go ahead.
Well, again, the chambering, by the way, this was all, as many so-called discoveries many times are, a result from as much accident as anything. It was requested that I construct or custom build several rifles for folks that are engaged in the professional guide business way up north of us. And they requested that I build a configuration bolt action rifle around specifically around that they asked for, which was the improved Magnum 375 that we're discussing here this evening.
Mm-hmm.
Ballistically. And I kind of half thought that I could see some of their reasoning behind their specifications and design requests, but on the other hand, I certainly didn't look forward to having to do a lot of shooting with a little 8-pound rifle, as it turned out, chambered for that type of round, because very predictably it turned out to be extremely brutal recoil-wise. And, you know, my estimations ahead of time proved to be very correct on that as a result from the live fire test.
So it helped to be a big man with a lot of beef on your shoulders to handle that.
Exactly. It also was something that even for a 250-pounder would be highly unpleasant to sit for an afternoon and fire from a bench rest, you know, even at that. It was almost strictly an offhand, you know, small configured, short, stubby, fast-handling little rifle chambered for this round, which later became key to an entirely different type of project. Which was geared not for close-range brush busting, as is commonly referred to in hunting circles, but more the long-range, extreme-range type work normally associated with either big varmint hunting or in the military sniping. And as it worked out, it only took a little bit of research and a fast review for me of, again, available factory projectiles in that diameter compared to anything larger, but still below 50 caliber, throughout the available 40 caliber category, to know that this thing potentially possessed all of those ballistically desirable factors that we would want to try to get something to go accurately for 1,000 yards or so.
Okay, hold your thoughts there. We're going to be right back, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this short pause. Those programs like this will only be heard on the hour of the time. Nobody else has the guts to bring you programming like this, to tell you the truth, tell you like it is, to prepare you for the hardships that lie ahead for all of us as the New World Order struggles to be born. On paper, in secret, it's already here. No one that I know of has the guts to sponsor a program like this except for Swiss America Trading. Now, you owe them a certain degree of loyalty if you're accepting the information and if you're going out and digging and researching and finding out the truth of what you hear on this program. Because remember, our admonition is to listen to everyone, read everything, believe nothing unless you can confirm it in your own research. If you are deriving real worth from this program, if you are going to prepare for the future, you should be loyal to those who are helping you prepare by giving you information. Now, that's not the only reason that you should call Swiss America Trading. The best that I can think of is that they're honest. Every single part of any dealings that you have with them will be imparted to you. You will be given notices of everything that applies to your dealings with Swiss America Trading, including their buyback policy, including any guarantees that they have or don't have. Everything is tape recorded before whatever your purchase is shipped off to you, so that there can be no misunderstanding whatsoever. And not only that, but I have given you and will continue to give you my personal guarantee that if you feel that you've been cheated, or if anything illegal or unethical or immoral has taken place in your dealings with Swiss America Trading, I will personally investigate, and if you're right, I will ask them to refund your money. And if they don't, then they will no longer sponsor this program, and that is the truth. Now, as far as I've been able to determine, they have never, ever committed any illegal, unethical, or immoral acts toward any of their customers in their history. And they're good, honest people. We did a thorough investigation, folks, before we accepted them to sponsor the Hour of the Time. So I can tell you right now that you're going to need the products that they can provide you in the coming months and years. And I advise you highly to call them now, tonight, and begin to prepare. There's not much time left, folks. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Normally on Monday night we have a metal report by Gene Miller from Phoenix. That won't be until tomorrow night simply because of the important programming that we're bringing to you now. So call 1-800-289-2646. Mention my name, William Cooper. Ask for all the free literature that you're entitled to as a listener to the Hour of the Time. Thank them for sponsoring this program. But most of all, find out how you can protect yourself and your loved ones against total financial destruction in the near future. Do it now, folks. 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. I hope you're all listening tonight and learning the information that you're getting here. You're not likely to run across anywhere else unless you are a professional in this trade, in this industry that John is a part of. The clock that you hear ticking off in your head right now is really there, and it's really ticking, and we're running out of time. Now, when you developed this weapon for these hunters, which is what they were, professional hunting guides, really, and you saw what it could do, and you got involved in that project, and then you began to think about something long range, way out, because evidently the ballistics and the capabilities of this round, because you really hadn't envisioned a rifle yet, gave you the feeling that this could be accomplished, and then you began to go from there. What was it that you, well, you've already told us a little bit about that, but what did you find was probably the best action to be able to chamber this round in a bolt-action rifle?
Well, Bill, I've always had a high degree of respect for the old, what we call, large ring Mauser action, also known as the 98 Mauser or 9809. Anyhow, there's various both commercial and military designations for that old action, all of which share one important characteristic as it pertains to reliability, and that is the world famous pioneer bulletproof, in my terminology, extraction system inherent in the Mauser system. And we've had over the years, both in and out of arsenal manufacture, many other variations or spin-offs on the Mauser system action. Two of which come to mind immediately are the U.S. or American very famous Springfield 03 A3, the U.S. 1917 Enfield, not to be confused with the British Lee Enfield from the U.K., but the American product, both of which, by the way, on those other variations, the 03 A3 Springfield as well as the 17 Enfield, originally chambered in the military 1906 round, or more commonly referred to as the 30-06,
mm-hmm.
old venerable both military as well as sporting cartridge. Now, the reason that an extraction system, second to none, was such an important consideration in the original research and development of this long-range rifle system and wildcat cartridge combination was the fact that more often than not, when you become engaged in reconfiguring or slang terminology, wildcatting, changing cartridges in their shape, dimension, configuration, and so forth, characteristically, you're also involved in a situation where you're inherently shortening the life of that brass casing.
Uh-huh.
Because you're contorting and bending, if you will, and further extruding and stretching that metal to a point where you are crystallizing and literally work hardening that metal, and therefore rendering it far more susceptible to rupture, fracture, etc.
So the number of times it can be reloaded is limited.
That's right. Normally. Amazing thing in this case is that, getting back briefly to the formation of the cartridge in the Wildcat form from the, going back to the original Holland and Holland configuration, it is first off one of the simplest to Wildcat in the procedure. Wildcat cartridges known to man is simply essentially a one step operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is back to that term fire forming. You literally do, in fact, it's recommended both economy and time wise that you do simply start out with a factory loaded Holland and Holland round, shuck that round into the chamber and touch it off. And in so doing, you have literally at 50 to 52,000 copper units of pressure reformed that casing in one simple, easy step. When you cycle that action and eject that case, you see a transformed casing.
Now, I've looked at a regular 375 H&H Magnum round and a 375 H&H Improved Magnum round, and it's got quite a bit of new room in there. How much on a percentage basis do you think it can be filled with more projectile or more powder, as we call it,
or propellant?
Propellant. That's the word I'm looking for.
Right. The net gain in volumetric capacity is 25%.
And that's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And that's accomplished through, number one, eliminating the extreme taper characteristic of the original Holland and Holland casing, extending the shoulder, therefore shortening the so-called neck configuration of the original casing, extending that shoulder out or forward 68 thousandths of an inch, and altering the shape of the shoulder to an angle of 40 degrees, which is much sharper than the original very shallow 60-degree shoulder found on your Holland and Holland casing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, in so doing, we've just accomplished all of those changes in configuration with one simple additional operation, normally over and above what is normally found in a typical loading operation. And that is, we've just circumvented all those extra 4 to 7 case-forming dies very commonly found in a typical Wildcatter's loading bench complement of tooling.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminated all of that. We're right back after that initial fire-forming down at the local shooting range or out behind your house for those folks that live in rural areas. We return to the loading bench utilizing a typical two-die set of dies.
So we haven't weakened the shell that would normally take place. The weakening of the shell that would normally take place in the old method of improving the round has not taken place.
Well, frankly, Bill, I anticipated that some weakening or crystallization would occur metallurgically myself. That's one of the reasons that I knew that I had to be working ultimately with a Mauser system action in case there were ruptures, you understand, in 2 or 3 reloadings.
Uh-huh.
We would be dealing with an action capable certainly of extracting even a broken or ruptured casing. However, I can give you actual records whereby the typical case life of this fire-formed Wildcat exceeds the typical factory case life of the 30-06 casing. We're talking on record logbooks indicating 10 to 12 reloadings So therefore, what I'm trying to say is that no appreciable loss of case life or shortening of case life did occur. Very amazing to me.
So almost everything that you began with expecting to happen, you found really just the opposite, that just about everything that you've done in the manufacture of this weapon has surprised everybody, hasn't it?
Far more than, let's say it by far exceeded expectations. That's correct.
Yeah. And that's an understatement, I can assure you. So in your expectations that there could be rupturing and be specifically because of the amount of propellant that is now in this round compared to what there was designed to be in this round, you chose a Mauser, a large ring locking Mauser action.
Mm-hmm.
And you found that this indeed is the best for this round. And
incidentally, Bill, not just the best for this round or this type of project, but I've got to make the generalization statement that it's probably the superior action for someone to select in any chambering, that is to say, any caliber, in an intended application situation where reliability is the keynote, or reliability is the prime consideration.
Well, lack of reliability transfers into liability, so you were right the first time.
Freudian slip. You know. But anyway, I think it's hard to go wrong. In fact, virtually impossible to go wrong with a Mauser system action for that reason, as well as one other. And that is the initial method of formation or construction or manufacture of the action to begin with. Now, there are a couple of loose copies of the original Mauser system action available on today's current production commercial market, one of which is available from Ruger. Now, I'm not here to detract from or otherwise badmouth Ruger, but I must say that it typifies the very comparison that I had in mind making here for the benefit of those out there that are interested in not necessarily going into the extreme range category of rifles, custom builds, and etc., but let's say just making the effort to achieve the highest degree of potential that they may be able to realize out of their current more standard chambered, standard caliber rifle that they may now own.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that Ruger, as well as several other available center fire turn bolt actions on the market, are they utilize in their means of manufacture a procedure known as investment casting. Now, an investment casting is very simply metallurgically what we call a constantly changing or destabilized piece of steel, meaning that it is very highly susceptible to distortion, expansion, contraction from various outside influences. Temperature is one, stresses are another.
And when these happen, especially in extreme situations, then it's subject to breakage.
Not just breakage, but the distortion is extremely detrimental in situations where you're trying to achieve the utmost in precision. What I'm trying to say here is that you have two methods of manufacture, basically, in the formation of a typical receiver. One is the very modern, very current method of investment casting already mentioned in connection with Ruger and others.
Mm-hmm.
The other method, much more traditional in the arms trade, arms manufacture trade, has been what is known as forging or a forged machining, whereby a solid billet of high carbon ordnance tool steel is literally hammer forged into a rough form, And then final precision machine operations are performed to bring it to its final precision configuration. Now, that formation is what you call a very stable, or what we call settled piece of steel, molecularly speaking, very low susceptibility to distortions from temperature changes, stresses, and etc. Lending itself to a much greater degree to the kind of ultimate accuracy that naturally you're after when you're trying to build a precision long-range system.
So the way that this is manufactured not only has to do with whether or not it's going to be reliable and break, but it also has a great deal to do with the accuracy of the final weapon.
That's correct, Bill. I've got to say that that is the primary consideration, is the tendency toward distortion, or conversely, in the case of the forged machining, the lack of tendency toward distortion. That's correct.
Great. Now, so we now know the primary reason why you chose this particular action. How do the people out there find this? Where are some places where they can find the type of action that we're talking about for this weapon that they want to build?
It almost comes down to a situation of scrutinizing your every 2 weeks issue of Shotgun News, haunting gun shows in your area if they still continue, as deteriorating as our political atmosphere is with regard to firearms, trade, and availability. More or less scrounging almost every little old gun shop or retailer that you can find in your area for even what would appear to be a beat up, kind of raggedy old Springfield, if necessary, or certainly Mauser, DWM, or Erfurt, or any of those common original issue. German, Brazilian is fine, Mauser actions that possess the properties and characteristics that we've discussed beforehand here.
Is there anyone who manufactures these kinds of actions today?
The closest to it, in fact, one of the finest choices for this type of project, as well as some smaller caliber projects, along this line, or with the objectives we've already discussed in mind, have been, up to about now, the Interarms Whitworth or Mark 10, a series of barreled actions, as well as complete, already stocked rifles. But unfortunately, world events such as they are overtaking Yugoslavia, or the former Yugoslavia, I should say, and the breakup therein has virtually curtailed production. And by the way, this is where Interarms secured their product for import into the U.S., known as the Whitworth or the Mark 10 rifle. And we're to a point now where there is virtually no availability, finally. In fact, I had anticipated that a year or two ago we'd be out of supply, very simply, in domestically. But it's taken this long for us to finally deplete those stocks that were already imported and at the distributor level.
Now, when I purchased mine, I know there were five left, and I know that as of yesterday, there are now two left.
Right.
And so people are going to have to go and find these other Mauser actions, and if they can find one, they can build this rifle.
That's correct, Bill. That's why I made a point of enumerating the derivative systems from the original Mauser, being, again, specifically the old Springfield 03A3 available surplus, still today here and there where you find them, as well as the old 1917 Enfield model. both originally chambered 30-06. Interesting note that 1917 U.S. Enfield is still today holds the distinction of being the world's hardest, that is on the Rockwell scale, piece of metal ever used in a rifle receiver. That thing runs way up in the low 80s on the Rockwell scale for hardness.
So
that's good from a durability and friction resistance standpoint. Real bad from the average little gunsmith's machine shop standpoint, because the only thing for example, scope mounting purposes, drilling and tapping, other attenuating machine operation standpoint that will even scratch that 1917 Enfield action generally is either tungsten carbide tooling, as in bits and cutters and whatnot, or cobalt. Very hard. So it there are other methods that are used to machine and drill and tap and so forth, the old 17 Enfield, for the necessary alterations and customization that has to occur, but it it's certainly not convenient for the average custom gunsmith.
Of course not. Okay, that just about wraps it up for this hour, folks, and we want you to make sure that you stay tuned for the next hour, which will be 9 Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, and midnight Eastern Standard Time, where we will talk about the barrel, where we will talk about how to find a gunsmith that can put these things together. We'll talk about a compensator. We'll talk about bedding this action and floating the barrel in the stock. We'll talk about a bipod so that you'll have stability when you're, setting up your shot. And we'll talk about optics for this weapon. And if there's any time left, we'll take your calls. If not, well, that's the way it goes, folks. So make sure that you're right here later tonight for another episode of the Hour of the Time. Now, right off the bat, I want to give you Sheriff Mack's address again. And if you have not contributed to this attempt to overturn the Brady Bill, then I want you to do that right now. Make out a check and send it to him. This is for all of our freedoms, not just mine, and certainly not just Sheriff Max. And if you don't participate, just like if you don't participate in our Gannett stock buying attempt to take over, and we are going to take over that company, and we're going to get the truth out to the American people in the news media that's been taken away from us. If you don't participate, folks, in my estimation, you'll never be part of the solution. You're part of the problem. And if you're part of the problem, you're getting set for some real hard times, because nobody's going to like you. Richard Mack, Sheriff Richard Mack, Graham County Sheriff, 523 10th Avenue. 523 10th Avenue, Safford, Saffford, Arizona. 85546. That's Sheriff Richard Mack, Graham County Sheriff, 523 10th Avenue, Safford, Arizona, 85546. Good night, folks, and God bless you all.